welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns. I'm Rosemary Truman, founder and CEO of the Center for Advancing Innovation, and I'm very grateful and honored to have Charlie Andres of Wilson Sonsini on the call today. So Charlie, tell us a little bit about what you do in your background.
Sure, Rosemary. So thank you for having me. It's great to be here. What I basically do is at a 30,000 foot level, I help companies move the needle on getting to either the point where they have a product on the market or they're ready to have a liquidity exit. There are lots of things that go into that. I provide regulatory advice with the FDA when that's appropriate. We build patent portfolios. We provide transactional help with kind of standard documents, licenses, NDAs, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And then we also, sometimes help with crisis management. Usually crisis management has been something that is brought on by, short sellers or sort of activist board members. More recently, I think it's COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. You're in high demand right now, right?
Rosemary, I think, law firms generally have billable hour requirements. Mm-hmm. I bill, half of what I'm supposed to bill at the end of the month of April.
Wow.
Yeah.
So less in demand. So what kinds of companies do you focus on?
They sort of spread across maybe five areas, so therapeutics, diagnostics, med devices, a little bit of health tech and AI.
And what about the stage of the company?
We normally work with startups. Wilson Sonsini, mm-hmm. as you know, has been doing startups since 1961.
Wow.
Kennedy was still alive when Wilson was doing startups.
Wow.
We've taken startups like, Apple and Google public. We sold Genentech to Roche.
Mm-hmm.
We represent, it's approaching 4,000 private companies now.
Wow.
It's a tremendous amount.
So what are the most significant opportunities that you've seen from a legal standpoint that startups can embrace? What are some opportunities in the IP area or financing, employees, cap tables, transactions, licensing?
Yeah, thank you. Let's just start at a high level by saying that the basics, the fundamentals to succeed as a startup haven't changed. I mean, the COVID environment in some cases has maybe made it more difficult for some companies.
Mm-hmm.
And in other, circumstances, it's made it, it's created opportunities for other
mm-hmm.
companies.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamentals are, I think, sort of still the same. You need people who have a pretty clear vision of where they want the company to go. Not just, hey, we're going to go try something and see what happens. And if that doesn't work, then we'll pivot to something else over here. Building an IP portfolio that can withstand the pressure test of investor diligences mm-hmm. is also very significant, because without that portfolio, in many cases, a company simply won't get investors. And if you don't have money, then there's really not a lot that you can do. And so then that translates to the next thing, which is you need to sort of map out a pathway to get enough money so that you can hit a successful Series A. And usually at that point, you're pretty well launched.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of difficult time from inception to Series A that I think most often challenges companies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is you need a group of people who work well together with different talents.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to, as a founder or a co-founder or an early employee of a startup, be able to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of a myth that says that you do, but I don't know. I'm not certain who propagated that myth, but I think they were lying.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do need to do, or is to know where your strengths and weaknesses are.
Mm-hmm.
You take on roles that play to your strengths and work with other people who can do things that you don't do well.
Mm-hmm. So what do you look for in a management team other than kind of the multidisciplinary nature of it?
I'm going to ask you the same question in a minute. I think a couple of things. One is there's like a very delicate balance. To move a startup forward, you need to have drive and you need to have vision and you need to be able to follow that mm-hmm. and not easily be knocked off the path.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, your drive and vision can't be so singular
mm-hmm.
that you're not capable of taking good advice,
mm-hmm.
considering that advice and acting on that advice. And it's a delicate balance. If all you do is run around and ask advice, you're never going to guide a company.
Mm-hmm.
If you never take advice, you're going to sort of guide it over a cliff that really you and investors ultimately wouldn't prefer to go. What do you think?
Well, we're pretty scientific about it. We give a fluid intelligence test actually to all the entrepreneurs, and we look at their openness score, number one, because the openness score should be 80% or above. And we also look at their troublemaker score. Believe it or not, we need some troublemakers. We look at how narcissistic they are. We look for their compassion score. So, you know, if you have, if you're very, very open and you're very compassionate, but you're a low troublemaker, then you're not going to be a good leader because you actually have to be somewhat of a troublemaker to be a good leader. And we look at the mix amongst the team. So that's, those are kind of the personality characteristics. We also did a project for the Kauffman Foundation on why do startups fail. And we found that the number reason startups fail is their lack of capabilities across the members of the team. So we codified the capabilities that are required to have a very strong team. And mm-hmm. there are 32 of them. So when we have teams come into our challenges, for example, we evaluate them both on the fluid intelligence test, which also, by the way, measures their intelligence side of things, not just characteristics. Like that. And then on the other side, we look at their capabilities. And as they go through our challenges, we add people to their teams. We're constantly looking for mentors to add to the teams. So by the end of the challenge, we'll have 2 to 3 additional people on their team that are really strong, that help complement the team. Mm-hmm. So that's how we look at the teams. We also, you know, it's kind of like getting married. You know, our nickname is the Tinder for startups. And we really, given my illustrious...
An interesting image.
Yeah, actually, Nature Magazine coined us the Tinder for startups. We have 2 Nature Magazine articles and they said some really interesting things both times. But the title of the article is Tinder for Startups. And the article is all about the Center for Advancing Innovation. So I'm actually kind of proud of that because the guys on my team say, you know, people wait their whole lives to get published in Nature. Look what you did. So, yeah. So also it's like, you're getting married, you know, you don't want to have to break up because breaking up is not any fun for anybody on the team. So compatibility with each other is a really important characteristic in our view. And we want people to get rid of people on their team. So we actually have our accelerator model, we have 40 classes or 40 plus classes. And when we had our first challenge, which was the breast cancer startup challenge, we learned that the number one thing was the team. I mean, we learned, I took it for granted because I've run so many teams all around the world and I put teams together and I can kind of, I know when something's not working and take people off, put people on. But the team dynamics was the number one reason for success or failure in our first challenge. And then the next year we bumped up the number of training that we had on that in terms of how to even converse with each other. How do you set expectations? I mean, there are little things that sometimes introverts can't do very well. So we thought, well, we have to train on that because that helps keep the marriage together. So thanks for asking the question.
It's an interesting, I mean, I think you've sort of quantified it, you know, perhaps like a bit more, and I tend to go by sort of pattern recognition and gut feel.
Uh-huh.
I would just add one thing to that, right? I think also, in my experience, like every VC has their own secret sauce for how they evaluate a company, right? But you can kind of simplify it into three things. So the first is they sort of will give a relative weight to the company's technology. And that'll be like on a 1 to 5 scale or something. And then they'll do their own market analysis. They will almost never trust the market analysis of a company. But they will look at the company's market analysis to see sort of how the company thinks about it. And right. And then the third thing is they'll look at the experience of the team. And so the ability for the team to gel and the experience of the team in many cases are sort of measures. You could look at one and, you know, especially the experience. And if you have an experienced team that's done it before, then you already know that largely they get along, which is what you were saying, right? And VCs, especially if you've had a successful exit, will relative weight that like 1,000. And so, you know, if you have that, if you're a startup and you've done it before, that's like, we encourage people to put that sort of right at the top of their one pager. And I would imagine you do kind of the same thing.
Absolutely.
If you don't have that, well, then you have to point to other things, and that's okay too. Everybody has to sort of do this once or twice to get that experience. But I think we have a lot of overlap.
Yeah, we do. And you know, actually the point that you made about the market analysis. So I love financial modeling. And I think you can read someone's soul through a financial model, because we train on that significantly. And it's extremely important to triangulate assumptions and to show your thinking. And so, for example, I wouldn't even read a business plan if our team's put the financial model in and I can't see the assumptions and I can't see how they triangulated it, because it's usually tops down, bottoms up, and sideways. Got to do benchmarking. Then, you know, they haven't really thought through everything, because you'll come to different numbers depending upon what variables you look at. So the assumptions that go into the financial model are extraordinarily important, and actually shows the level of thinking and depth of thinking that the teams have done. So I completely agree with that as well. And you know, on the technology side of things, it's interesting because what we found through all, you know, we've launched 335 startups now. What we've seen is that if they really think through things, you know, the teams have a strong financial model, they have a good, strong team, but the technology just doesn't work, they'll just pick another one, you know, and we'll just give them another one, because they could just work on another thing, you know. So, and they've been, our teams have been very successful in doing that. Many times the technology hasn't worked.
Well, it's true. And I think the, you know, like the sooner you can get to a decision point about that, everybody is happier. Like if you tell an investor that, hey, we need $200,000 to build a prototype and test it, and we can do it in 3 months, that's one conversation. If you tell an investor we need, you know, 3.5 years to prepare for a clinical trial,
right,
And even our first clinical trial is only going to tell us if this compound is safe. That's a different conversation.
Yeah, very different. So you were mentioning, you know, IP, the IP portfolio is one of the core items to get, you know, to make sure that you've fortified, if you will, as part of being a successful startup. What are some tips that you have for the startups listening today about how to strengthen the IP portfolio?
So I guess a few, Rosemary, and see if these sort of also click with your experience, please. I think the first is to recognize that while, you know, patents are important, patents are just one part of what makes an entire company work. So whatever your patent strategy is, it has to fit with the other pieces of kind of the organization. And if it doesn't, then the greatest patent strategy in the world isn't going to save you. The kind of second thing is budgeting is really important to recognize that the patent systems are designed to be easy to get into, to enter, but harder to stay in. And so over time, your patent budget is going to have to increase. And that's going to have to be figured into what, how much you raise in an A round or a B round or a C round. The third is sort of being aware of the space that you operate in and that you're filing on. And filing, you know, different types of claims, but broad claims for startups, especially if you can get them issued, are very important. You know, investors look at those and they say, if you have this really broad claim, it's gonna sort of discourage competitors from entering into your space. The other thing that's interesting about those broad claims, though, is they can actually drive investors into the company. So last year, for example, at JP Morgan, I was talking to three or four VCs about a company that we represent. And they were actually saying to me, you know, we look at those broad claims and those scare us. And I kind of smiled and I'm like, good, because that means that scare you from investing in a competitor. And if you want to invest in this space, you're going to invest in us. So, you know, claims not only can drive investment into your company, but they can pull investments away from competitors. And that can be pretty significant. I think the last thing is you need to think about generally where you're going to file patent applications. We have some companies that maybe only file in one country in one jurisdiction. We have other companies that file just about everywhere that you can file on the globe. In some of these places, like it's a, and I've been doing, you know, patent work for about 20 years. Some of these countries, it's the first time I've ever seen an application in this country with their laws, because it's just so rare. So it, and again, that also plays into budgeting, because the more you file and the more countries that you file in, again, the more your budget increases over time.
And so, you know, I was thinking about one of our startups, the tuberculosis startup, and they filed in just a few countries where the multi-drug resistant tuberculosis was growing more rapidly. And they were able to conduct clinical trials, of course, a lot more easily there. And of course, it was a lot cheaper for them. So there are strategic reasons to only file in certain countries and have certain claims. Makes sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's part of a, you know, a well thought out strategy. And by the way, what happened? How did their clinical trials go?
Oh, great. They're in, they're coming along. They're going on phase three. So the other one that actually one of our first batch of startups from the Breast Cancer Startup Challenge, one of the gentlemen, he called Oncolinks. They licensed the patent, very, very broad patent. And they realized that this invention could work as a platform to deliver drugs more in a more targeted way to the nucleus of the cell, the target. And then they were able to sublicense the invention to 11 companies. So they were making money right away. So it wasn't like they raised money too. They won the 43 North competition and, you know, a bunch of other competitions. They had $600,000 in their pocket before the end of the first challenge. So they were doing well, but I love the fact that they sublicensed those inventions because they had broad claims on them. So you had mentioned something about some of the companies are being more challenged. Some of the startups you're working with are being more challenged. Some of them are being less challenged. You know, they're more, there's more opportunity for some. Where are you seeing the ones that have the most challenge, and where are the ones that have more opportunity?
So venture capital investing is a bit like fashion. You know, maybe polka dots are in now, and maybe 6 months it's stripes, and 6 months later it's plaids. And so, for example, like immuno-oncology 3 or 4 years ago was a super hot area.
Mm-hmm.
If you had an IO company and mm-hmm. you got an Uber mm-hmm. and you put IO company on the sides of your Uber mm-hmm. and you had it driven down Sand Hill Road, mm-hmm. People would just throw money at you.
Pass yeah. by, right? Yes.
Now it's harder to fund IO companies because the polka dot fashion is now changed to stripes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing better funding in areas like gene editing and RNA mm-hmm. editing.
Mm-hmm.
People are responding positively to that.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a tremendous amount of COVID funding
yeah,
that's
right.
out there.
yeah.
Between us girls, Rosemary, I don't know how sustainable that is. In other words, like I think it is something that's important,
mm-hmm.
but I suspect that like if testing becomes widespread and mm-hmm. and there are a couple of drugs that become effective or something like that, you may see attention wane from COVID, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely going to be one of those things like comedy, right? Where timing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of examples, like trend spotting within venture capital funding can be helpful, and trying to sort of figure out what the next wave is and then paddling your surfboard out there and, mm-hmm. and being able to catch that wave.
Well, so since you mentioned it, what do you think is going to be in fashion next? Flowers, right?
Flowers. Yeah. I think regenerative medicine. So, for example, one of the companies, can I mention a company on this or is that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the companies that we represent is Miramatrix. They're located in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is basically taking, let's say like a liver from an animal that is slaughtered in a slaughterhouse, like mm-hmm. a pig. They decellularize that liver or kidney or other types of organs. And so you're left with the underlying matrix
mm-hmm.
where the blood vessel pathways and everything are still mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they recellularize that with human cells.
Oh, interesting.
And so you could imagine, I mean, we were on a call the other day and there are, maybe 70,000 people in the U.S. who want liver transplants.
Mm.
But in any given year, maybe there's between like 8,000 and 10,000 livers available.
Mm-hmm.
And so, these guys are making great progress. And once they solve the last few pieces of this puzzle, pretty much anyone who needs a liver will be able to have one on demand. That kind of regenerative medicine is hugely powerful. So that's one mm-hmm. area. The other area that, and this is a bit more speculative, okay, but I think at some point the FDA is going to determine that aging is a disease.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and
I agree with you.
I think, if you look in the aging space, for example, like David Sinclair is a luminary in this space. He wrote a book called Lifespan, which is phenomenal. But even in the dietary supplement world, there's a dietary supplement called Basis that's made by Elysium Health.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to their website, and I'm not plugging it, they're not a client, I don't have stock in them. But they have 8 or 9 Nobel Prize winners on their SAP.
Wow.
And they've got a group of people just below that, many of whom, like George Church, for example, probably will be future Nobel Prize winners.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a dietary supplement, right? This is, like you can go in, they sell it through the internet. And right now you mm-hmm. couldn't go to GNC and buy it anyway because everything is closed.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a recognition that if you can slow the aging process upstream, mm-hmm. then you can also slow kind of the some of the things that go along with aging further downstream. And that could be an extremely hot area.
So I wonder if you would start with children. Would you start the aging process, start trying to slow the aging process mm-hmm. with children? So we're doing this children's health challenge. It's going to be announced on Thursday. So for everybody watching the podcast, you got to hear it first. And we have some really exciting inventions in it, but I would love to hear your perspective on, you know, the aging process starting with children.
You know, I think it's a delicate balance. So there are certainly things that you could, you know, envision doing that probably would have benefit and not much risk. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one who's thinking about this also has to be cognizant of all the growth and changes that children undergo on their way to becoming adults. Mm-hmm. And so I think initially there could be some interventions that mm-hmm. could be useful. And then once you get through the growth and differentiation process, maybe you could increase those, but you just don't want to interfere with the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What can you hypothesize that could be done? I mean, obviously good nutrition, you know, avoiding sugary snacks. I mean, things that could actually help promote growth, and probably recycling of cells, you'd want to promote, but what are your thoughts?
So one of the things I like is, all those things are good, right? Sort of diet within reason, exercise within reason, you know, allowing children to be children, you know, as mm-hmm. opposed to treating them as little adults. Sort of adults who march off and work 18 hours a day. That's reserved for people like lawyers.
not really. It's reserved for us too, strategy consultants. Right. I don't feel like I do work these days, even though I do a lot of work, but it's not work for me.
But I think there are some things, right? Like there are four major kind of pathways that are thought to be associated with aging. There's a pathway, the sirtuinin pathway, which can be influenced by taking things like nicotinamide riboside. Mm-hmm. It's a precursor to a molecule that your body already makes. It's probably harmless, although do not take this as medical advice and don't go run off. Try this with your child. I am not an MD. I'm not a pediatrician. You know, as people get a little bit older, or if you're seeing fluctuations early in blood sugar, like lower levels of metformin might be good, because metformin influences the AMPK pathway, which mm-hmm. is also associated with aging. Mm-hmm. You know, then it gets a little dicier. Things like rapamycin, which bind to, strangely enough, the molecular target of rapamycin or mTOR. Putting people on and off of those periodically could, you know, potentially be interesting. And then sort of the last thing, which really wouldn't impact children at all, but you'd be watching for, it would be sort of there's a limit that cells hit where they'll no longer divide. Mm-hmm. And if those cells don't die, or if they're not killed off, what mm-hmm. happens is they sort of become little factories that pump out all sorts of inflammatory molecules. So at the adult level, being able to, you know, take those things out, those cells out, to mm-hmm. keep inflammation under control. At the childhood level, maybe looking at markers of inflammation that have meaning. Mm-hmm. And then taking steps to lower those markers of inflammation into a less elevated range if they're high.
Mm-hmm. What would a marker be?
So an example of general inflammation is C-reactive protein. Many times, like maybe when you get an annual physical, you'll get a blood draw, And the more comprehensive ones will have things like C-reactive protein in them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great marker because anything can set it off. If you know, we were talking earlier about lifting weights, right?
Yeah.
You and I both lift weights.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have an intense exercise session, your C-reactive protein can go up. If you happen to have a cold on the day you get a blood draw, your C-reactive protein can go up. Right? So it's over time, if you get several tests, maybe it's a general marker of inflammation. It's kind of hard to say that one result means anything.
Mm-hmm.
But finding more specific markers other than C-reactive protein and finding ways either environmentally or through diet, through exercise, through activating the parasympathetic nervous system, dietary supplements, drugs, things to lower those. I think, you know, many of the people who were born now will likely live to see at least 100.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, 20 years, maybe those folks could live to be 125 or more.
Wow.
It's pretty significant.
Hmm. So we were talking before about, the opportunities for startups. What do you think the largest challenges are? Are they just the opposite of what we just discussed, the management team, the IP portfolio, et cetera?
I'm going to ask you at some point to come up with a test for this, right? a quantitative test, because
yes.
I don't have one. But I can tell you that when I sit down with people, I've done this enough now, I have a sort of I form an impression.
Uh-huh.
And that impression isn't always 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
But I get a pretty good idea of who is more likely to succeed and who's not.
Mm.
And, you know, so about a year ago, because it's coming around now, but they won't hold it this year because of COVID, I was on a panel at the World Healthcare Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, there was a group of like investors and others having lunch, a pre-panel lunch, maybe like 30 people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a VC chest beating thing. Like one VC said, well, I look at, you know, 100 companies for every one I invest in. And the next one said, well, I look at 900 companies. And somebody got up to, you know, some number that was over 1,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when they got to me, they said, what do you think? And I said, you know, don't take this the wrong way. But if I transferred your paradigm into hiring someone for an organization and I was responsible for that and I had to interview 1,000 candidates before I picked one, they would fire me or at least remove
yeah.
from the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really, what you guys need, sort of, is a way to, you know, better and more quickly pick companies.
Mm-hmm.
You see fewer of them, you know, because you've got some kind of screening process,
mm-hmm.
You end up investing in more of them faster. So you spend maybe not 2 years in deal sourcing, but maybe you spend 5 months. And then your whole life cycle, your investment life cycle can shrink, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, I could see like a bunch of heads starting to nod.
Yeah, that's okay. Great. That's great.
And then the follow-up question, of course, was, well, you know, how do we do this? And I started laughing and I said, you know, if I had that answer at, you know, my fingertips, I wouldn't be sitting here, right? I would be out, you know, either selling you my paradigm or I would be doing it myself.
Well, Charlie, this is interesting because, you know, as you know, we work with about 120 institutions across the United States, and we have a database of about 170,000 plus inventions. And when we perform due diligence, we query the database and based on a bunch of variables to try to find the inventions that are in the scope of what we're looking at. So there's thousands that come out, you know, so for the Children's Health Challenge, there was about 7,000 inventions. So it wasn't too many. I mean, that's actually not too many for us. Usually there's more. For the Neuro Startup Challenge, there's about 30,000. What's interesting though, is then we have this series of shortlisting because we want to kill the inventions. We want to kill them as quickly as possible so that we don't have to perform a deep dive due diligence on the ones that are not good. And so we have all these methodologies to, we have like 8 categories we look at altogether to try to kill the ones that are going to be not have the impact in the right area, the social impact in the right area, and not have the commercial viability. So we're able to get through all those inventions, like for example, the Children's Health Challenge in 2 months. And then the hardest part is actually reaching out to all the institutions that own them to find out if they're available, because half the time they're not available. We don't know though, because we're just looking at the patent or the patent families that are around the invention. So then usually about half of them go, and then we further chop. And then we, when it gets down to the, like a small number, like 50, we can then apply our entire due diligence model. And then when it gets down to about, for example, for the Children's Health Challenge, when we got down to 100, we applied our deep dive due diligence, and then we got down to 50. And then we have a selection committee we put together of children's health experts, multidisciplinary, you know, the venture side of things, the foundation side of things, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the physician side of things, and then they perform the final selection. So it's possible. And we have a formula for that, because I've had to do that for like 24 years in strategy consulting. So we wouldn't get through any engagements if we didn't have that models like that. So it does exist. I once sat down with this this venture group. I'll never forget if I lived to be 100. And GSK had given them a large amount of money to run a fund. I think it was $500 million fund. And I showed him some inventions. He was interested in inventions in a certain area. So we found some that were of interest to him, performed the due diligence on them, shared with him the due diligence. And he said, "Oh my gosh, I would never do this much work." It was the funniest thing, because you know that's what we did. We do that all the time.
So let me raise 2 points, right? Because I think, or tease out 2 points from what you just said, because I think they're important. So the first is, absolutely, it can be a bit of a nightmare to try to figure out what IP is available and what IP isn't.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a tech transfer organization doesn't keep their website current. Mm-hmm. So you think something is and it's not, or you think something's not and it's become available. Available is also a relative term.
Right.
If it takes you 6 months or a year to get a license.
Oh gosh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But the other thing, and this is really important to what you were saying, we work with some organizations that have venture arms. Mm-hmm. And for their venture arms, and because of the nature of the organizations, they're able to draw on a very wide variety of KOLs in the field, key opinion leaders. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they have like a core of folks, but then as they need people in any given diligence, they just have this huge Rolodex and they pull them in. Mm-hmm. And you know, the standard kind of often quoted figure in startup world is one out of 10 make it. Mm-hmm. We've seen that their numbers are actually significantly higher. Hmm. You know, and so I think there's some VCs who try to emulate that. They have their own consultants, and you know, they'll bring in the cardio guy for this invention, mm-hmm. and the onco guy for that invention, and the Pulma girl for this invention. Mm-hmm. But so far, I think honestly, in terms of if you look at you know, averages, mm-hmm. this model of, you know, core with, you know, kind of a deep bench, mm-hmm. Seems to be infinitely more successful.
Yeah. I mean, having the right people evaluate the technology, it's critically important. And it's just as important to evaluate the team. That's why when the teams come in, we do the fluid intelligence test and the capability assessment. And then we keep monitoring that throughout the challenge, because you know the teams change. And when we add, and that's why we add particular mentors, matching the mentors to the teams. That works out really well. I mean, we've gotten so many, our teams have been very complementary. I guess we've been fortunate to be able to match them well. That's also a kind of an interesting process as well. And I wanted to mention your point on licensing is extremely important. So when we first started the Breast Cancer Startup Challenge, we piloted a new licensing model, a startup friendly licensing model? Because, you know, first of all, if you have an upfront payment of $1.5 million, you're not going to go anywhere, right, for a startup. So we piloted this model. It worked really well. And so we work with this startup, the startup friendly model, with all the institutions we work with. The model is definitely not the same across the board, but we have agreements to at least have startup friendly terms and make them the licensing process go quickly. 3 to 6 months versus, I mean, sometimes, you know, licensing could take 2 years for large companies.
It creates a sort of bias, doesn't it, Rosemary? Yeah. And I'm not saying, you know, that bias is good or bad. I'm just saying it is.
Yeah.
If you have a handful of institutions who have reasonably attractive technology and they understand the space and they work with you to quickly give you a license, which is valuable, mm-hmm. More and more, you're going to be looking towards those institutions. You're going to become biased towards those. Mm-hmm. And if you've got another institution where maybe people really don't have a lot of experience and so they don't fully know what they're doing, they're on one hand afraid to make a decision, and on the other hand, because they don't license a lot of things, maybe they think each thing they're licensing is going to lead to a unicorn, right?
Right.
When in fact, most of them are going to lead to a pile of discarded patents.
Unicorn tears.
Right. You're going to bias yourself. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, right? Maybe it's really good because but maybe it's bad for these other institutions because they're actually hindering their mission, which is to try to translate that technology into the marketplace.
I know. Yeah. Well, I want to move to another topic I would like your opinion on. We haven't talked about this, but you know, the Center for Advancing Innovation, we have this model where we start with the invention. We then match it with talent through the challenge process. And then the third leg of the stool is to launch an investor form. So it's a trifecta, the invention, the talent, and then the capital. In fact, we have an investor form coming up for our scale challenge on September 24th. Mm-hmm. And another one, we're gonna be doing a virtual investor forum June 4th, which you have been very generous to provide us some funding for. So we appreciate that. It's gonna be June 3rd, actually, not June 4th. So, you know, how do you think this model is beneficial in these challenging times? I mean, it's a virtual model, so that's always good. But what are your thoughts?
Let's go from 30,000 feet down. Mm-hmm. You and I have both read the report that say actually the number of startups in the U.S. is shrinking.
Yes.
And has been shrinking since, depending on who you read, like the late 1980s or the mid 1990s. At the same time, you read economic analyses that say that, you know, small companies and startup companies are the engine of growth for the economy. You know, those two numbers don't tell a good long-term story. Mm-hmm. If you know the number of engines that drive your economy is going down, that's not a good thing. So I think what you're doing is in a sense vitally important because you're trying to, I don't want to say single-handedly reverse that trend, but you're trying to have a significant impact and maybe an inflection point in that trend. And so that has local and national implications.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlie. I'm very grateful. Actually, Ross Duvall, who I had on the podcast, he is the head of Heartland Forward. So they're boosting economic growth in the Heartland. And he was a top economist in the world, one of the top economists in the world. He was at the Milken Institute for a long time. He's coming out with a report on startups that is going to be very exciting, and it speaks to exactly what you just said. And it also will be talking about, you know, the impact from a knowledge-based job standpoint, and a lot of other ways they've analyzed the data. It's very, very interesting. So I'm going to interview him for that when he's done with that. I guess just to wrap up here, you know, what advice would you leave for the people who are listening to the podcast today? What's your last bit of insight?
I think my last bit of insight would be seek out good advice and follow it.
Be open to it, right?
Yeah, you're open to score, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay, awesome. Well, Charlie, I'm very, very grateful for your providing all of your valuable insights today. It's been a fantastic podcast, and stay well during this coronavirus. Hopefully we're going to get out of it and be on the other side and be able to launch more startups, right? And you'll be billing at 120%.
At some point, Rosemary, I do need to sleep. I haven't conquered that.
Okay.
But thank you for having me on. This has been, as always, an enjoyable discussion. And hopefully we can do it again in better times.
Yes, we will. We will indeed. Thank you so much, Charlie. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Rosemary. You too. Take care.